Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Book of Genesis. Today we're going to be in Genesis chapter 2 and dealing with a very unusual account in the life of Jacob. I hope you'll turn with me. I think it's going to surprise you, some of the things in this chapter. We're going to be trying to deal with the whole chapter. As is usual in studying the Bible, the context of a passage is as crucial as the passage itself. God has been dealing now with Jacob for several passages. Clear back in chapter 25, we begin his birth, and in chapter 28 is his call at Bethel. And now he's returning to the land of promise, which he's left for all these years, because of the terrible manipulation and hatred and lying that he did to his own family when he left. And we're kind of summing up now the life of Jacob. Jacob, as you'll look back in chapter 25, was named because when he was born, he was holding on to his brother's heel. And they looked for something in a child, his mannerisms, his looks, his color, to name him. So when they saw this child somehow hold on to his brother's foot, they gave him the name usurper or grabber. We might call it trickster. And Jacob lived up to his name. You want to talk about a turkey? Jacob was a turkey. This is one of those Bible passages that help us relate to our own world. Jacob really played the fool for most of his life. And here in chapter 32, his name is going to be changed. It's going to become a tremendous spiritual crisis in his life. He has been running in chapter 31 from Laban, who he cheated. And now he's confronted with his brother Esau, who he cheated. And he's just out of tricks now. I think it's very interesting that we see that the Bible is not made up of superhuman people or extremely spiritual people. It's made up of people just like you and me and your friends and neighbors, but people who were at least willing to let God work in their life. And that's the kind of guy Jacob is. So let's look at the Bible if we could. Genesis 32. Now, as Jacob went on his way, now, many people make a big deal about him going on his right way, but really he's just leaving Laban, coming back into the promised land that God asked him and commanded him to do. As he was on his way, the angel of the Lord met him. Now, let's stop for a minute and see if we can catch the picture here. The word met is a Hebrew word that implies physical contact. These angels of God were present when he left Bethel in the land of promise earlier. If you remember the account, he was at Bethel. He saw a ladder descending from heaven. He saw God at the top of the ladder speaking to him. The angels were ascending and descending. That was the vision which he left the promised land to go find his wife with his relatives over in Mesopotamia. Now he's coming back to the promised land. These angels appear again. Now exactly who and what they are, I think, is beyond our scope of being dogmatic. They seem to be the messengers of God for all kinds of purposes. They sometimes take humanoid form, sometimes not. And it just says the angels of God met him. Then it says, and Jacob saw, and Jacob said when he saw them, this is God's camp. And he named the place Mahanaim. Now, there are several things happening here. When he saw the angels, he recognized that he wasn't alone. He had been coming back with all his herds and his cattle and his camels and his donkeys and all that, and his family. And it was a large group of people. And by seeing these angels, I think he recognized that he wasn't by himself. He was about to come into a crisis situation. He had just left a crisis situation. He's about to come into even a worse one with his brother Esau. And I think it's comforting to him to know that as he left the land of promise, the angels were there. As he comes back, they're there. We could almost picture them as a military entourage to escort him into the land. There are some precedents for this. I think in 2 Kings chapter 6 is the account of Elisha and the Syrian army at the town of Dothan. And God opened the servant of Elisha's eyes and he saw the horses and chariots of fire all around. I think there is a spiritual realm that is coexistent and penetrating and impacting our world. I have a tape that I've done called What Battle? That is based on Ephesians chapter 6, verses 10 and following, that deals with these supernatural presences in our life. If you'll write for me, I'll send you that tape, What Battle? That deals with this spiritual realm, this angelic world, both good and evil, that affects our life daily, which so often we take for granted and don't even realize that we're in the presence of that invisible realm. Jacob saw them, and he named the place Two Camps. Now, it's not really a plural form in Hebrew. It's a dual form. It means two camps, two armies, two groups. And so it seems it's speaking of the angelic group and of Jacob's group. Now, notice where it mentions in verse 3, then Jacob sent messengers. Now, it's surprising, in Hebrew and in Greek, the name for messengers and the name for angels is exactly the same word. So therefore, the rabbis say that Jacob sent the angels as messengers to Esau, but that doesn't fit the context at all. The angels aren't mentioned anymore after this initial encounter. Now, it says, messengers before him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. Now, some think that his brother was on a military raid down there and had all these warriors with him. I'm not real sure about that. Notice what it mentions in verse 4, and he commanded him, saying, thus you'll say to my lord Esau. Now, this is the word Adon. We get the word Adonai from it, which is a name for God that's inserted by the Hebrews into the text where Yahweh appears, so they won't take the covenant name for God in vain. It is more of a polite term here. It's a title of courtesy. He's not saying my brother Esau. It's a way of saying my superior. It's just a polite term. The same kind of thing occurs in the New Testament with the word kurios, which is the word translated Lord there. Several times it's used in a theological sense of Jesus' deity, whosoever shall call the name of the Lord. Other times it simply means sir, and Cornelius said to the angel, sir, what do you want? And so it's this courtesy title mixed with theological title, and it's the same use in the Old Testament. Now, when it mentions, thus you shall say to your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed until now, but I have oxen, donkeys, flocks, male and female servants I have sent to tell my Lord, there is again, that I may find favor in your sight. Look at verse 6. And the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, we came to meet your brother Esau, and furthermore he is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him. Notice what happened. The brother did not send any message back. He didn't say, oh, Jacob, I'm so glad to see you. It's been so long. Welcome home. Matter of fact, the reason Jacob left, did you remember? Jacob was a mother's boy, and Esau was Isaac's favorite, and Rebekah and Jacob tricked Esau out of his birthright by putting on hairy skins and getting the daddy who was blind to bless him. Then he tricked Esau out of his birthright, the red porridge deal. And not only, and when all of that had occurred, Esau said, I'm going to kill you as soon as we bury our daddy. And when Rebekah heard it, she told Jacob to flee, and he ran for his life 20-something years earlier. And now he's coming back. He's not sure Esau's not still mad at him. No answer. Bringing 400 men. Does that sound like a welcoming party to you? Look at the next verse. Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. I bet he was too. And he divided the people that were with him into flocks and the herds and camels into two companies. Now, Jacob, this name trickster or usurper is a way of describing that Jacob is a pretty smart old boy. He's the kind of guy that we would call a con man in our day. He's able to trick things around and manipulate people and lie and cheat and just get things the way he wanted. He's still doing that. He's going to divide the companies up, and if one of them's killed, he'll have the other one. And all of this mental planning he's doing. But look what else he does. For he said, if Esau comes to one company and attacks it, then the company which is left will escape. Okay, he's still conniving, And then he begins a prayer in verse 9. He plans, then he prays. How often we do the same thing. And Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham and of my father Isaac, O Lord, who did say to me, there's three different parts here. First part is the God of the covenant. He's going back and saying, look, you're the God that made a promise to Abraham. You're the God that made a promise to Isaac. And you're the God that through my father's blessing has made some promises to me. You're my covenant God. Okay, that's where he starts with the God of the covenant. And then he says, you said some things to me. You made some promises to me personally. When he says, return to your country and to your relatives, and I will prosper you. Now here Jacob's saying, look, God, you told me to come back here. I'm just following your command. How come Esau's going to try to kill me? You know, what's the deal? I'm just obeying you. Why are you letting this happen? You know, that's a common thing for us. We really wonder why these things are happening to us. That's what Jacob is going through. Listen to what Jacob says next. I am unworthy of all the loving kindness and of all the faithfulness which thou hast shown me, shown to thy servant. For with my staff only I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two companies. Now, there's several important things. A little thing, I am unworthy, is very important. Many people talk about the Old Testament is law and the New Testament is grace. That's just not true. The Old Testament is as much grace as the New Testament. God came to Adam and Eve with a promise in Genesis 3:15 after they had really blown it bad. And yet he promised to redeem them, grace. Then he clothed them, grace. He came to Abraham. Abraham wasn't any different than the rest of his day. He wasn't more spiritual. God chose him, came to him, promised some things to him. God always comes in grace first. Jacob was a jerk, but God acted to him in grace. Jacob's just admitting the facts. I'm unworthy. I don't deserve what you've done for me. Yet you're right. Abraham wasn't either. Neither are we. All of God's acts toward man always initiate from God's action first. He always takes the initiative, and the first step is always grace. Now, there are obligations and responsibilities that come with a personal commitment to God, but they're always subsequent to grace. Now, notice what mentions these two words here, loving kindness, and mine has faithfulness. This is the two Hebrew words, hesed and emeth. Now, they are very important words. They are usually used together when describing God's character. The word hesed is a word that's only used in the context of the covenant people. It is a word that speaks of no strings attached covenant loyalty. God made a promise. God's going to keep his promise. I think it is synonymous to the New Testament term agape, which is no strings attached God's sacrificial love. I think they're two words with the same meaning in both Testaments. Now, the other word here, emeth, E-M-E-T-H, is a word that speaks not so much of truth, but of faithfulness. God can be depended on to act out what he says. And these two words describe God. Covenant loyalty, faithfulness. And those are two words that Jacob uses in his prayer. Now, when he says in verse 11, deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he come and attack me, mother with children. Now, Jacob is doing the very same thing that Abraham tried to do. God told Abraham he's going to have a son. So Abraham said, okay, my wife's too old. I'll just take a servant, and I'll have a son through a servant. That's where Ishmael came, and the whole Arabian tribes, the Arab people came from that kind of thing. No, God didn't mean that. The same thing now Jacob's trying to do. He's saying, look, God made me a promise that I'm going to have many children, and my wife and children are in danger now, so I've got to try to protect them. I've got to divide them into two companies. I've got to remind God of his promises. Jacob is showing that he's dependent now. He doesn't know how to accomplish what God promised. He's been trying to accomplish in his own strength what God told him. And now he's between a rock and a hard place and can't do anything but pray and trust. He still schemes, but he's praying too. Now, verse 12, for thou didst say, I will surely prosper you and make your descendants the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for their multitude. Now, that's part of the promise that God made to Abraham back in Genesis 12 and repeated it several times in Abraham's life, repeated it several times in Isaac's life. He's already repeated it in Jacob's life. He repeated it first at the first encounter with God at Bethel. He's going to repeat it again later in Jacob saying, look, you promised me this, God, and I don't understand how it's going to work out. All too often, we try to base our faith on our resources, not on God's promises. Jacob had to learn that he could not trust in his own resources, be it his wealth, be it his mental abilities, be it anything. And so what's going to follow is God having to work with Jacob to get Jacob to trust God, not Jacob. 13 through 20 is Esau still planning, man. He's going to divide the, he's going to send some cows and donkeys and stuff ahead of him in different groups and try to appease Esau's anger by his gifts. Old Jacob, still the trickster, still the manipulator, still the, you know. Now, in verse 22 and following is one of the strangest accounts in all the Old Testament. Now, I want to say something before I get into it. Number one, I can't answer all the questions, for there's a strange mixture here of anthropomorphisms, isn't that a wonderful $5 word, and truths about God and man. Who is this strange person that wrestles with Jacob? What exactly is his purpose? Why all the little details that don't seem to fit? I can't answer all those questions. I think the key is in Jacob's name change to Israel. Now, there's been much spiritualizing and allegorizing of this text. I must admit to you, I do not understand all of it. I will try to bring to the surface what I think we can legitimately say from the context. And beyond that, I feel uncomfortable. Now, and he arose the same night and took his two wives and his two maids, his 11 children, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. Now, the ford is the only place you can cross that river. And it's right at the mouth of that river as it runs in to the Jordan. Now, this is the word Jabbok means blue river. It's this beautiful stream that comes from the snows, and it runs most of the year. It's a very deep gorge, and the only place to cross it's down at the mouth, and that's usually pretty treacherous. So, this is the river that divides the promised land from the other. Now, notice in verse 23, and he took them and sent them across the stream, and he sent across whatever he had. Now, he's left by himself. Look at verse 24. And Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. Now, the word wrestled in Hebrew is similar to the word Jabbok. It's a rabbinical play on words here. And that's why I'm using the word wrestled. Now, who is this man? Well, in Hosea chapter 12, verse 3 and 4, this incident is recorded, and the man is said to be an angel. A little later on, in the same verses 26, 27, it seems to be God himself. And you might want to see chapter 48, 16, where it also seems to be deity. Martin Luther, and many Christian commentators since him, say it's Jesus Christ. And the first person to say this was Jesus is Justin, New Testament. No rabbis ever came up to this was the Messiah. Who is this person? Why is he wrestling? If he's God, can't he beat Jacob in a wrestling match? My soul. Why is he wrestling with Jacob at night anyway? What is the purpose of this? Okay. I don't think we can find all of it. I think we can find some of it. So how long they wrestle, we don't know. But it says, wrestled with him until daybreak. Now, why daybreak? We'll see how this all gets balled up in just a second. Look at verse 25. And we saw that he had not prevailed against him. Now, did it surprise you that Jacob was such a wrestler he couldn't beat an angel or God or the pre-incarnate Christ? Man, something's unusual happening here. He touched the socket of his thigh, so the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated while he was wrestling with him. Whoever this was had the power to dismember, in a sense, or make inable or somehow cripple Jacob. So he touched the socket, maybe a sciatic nerve. The Jews won't eat the vein in the leg to this day because of this account right here, and you see it in verse 32. So he cripples Jacob, and Jacob knew he couldn't win then, but Jacob holds on to him, won't let go. There's something about the tenacity of Jacob that's important here. It's not that the angel or human kind of anthropomorphic usage for God. It's not that God can't overcome Jacob. It's not that at all. It's that Jacob's tenacity is being tested here, like Abraham was tested with Isaac. Jacob is being tested here. And notice what it says. Then he said, "Let me go, for the dawn is breaking." Now, many folks have said what we have here is a river nymph that can't see the light of day or be destroyed. They say, well, it's kind of like Dracula. If he sees the light, it'll kill him. Where do we get that from? Something is happening here about the morning coming. Now, one of two possibilities. The rabbis say the angel had to get back to heaven to be in the morning choir that sings praises to God. One of two things is happening. Either the personage who's wrestling with Jacob, there's something that he's afraid of about mourning. Or either there's something dangerous to Jacob about mourning. Now, the implication of the context seems to be that if Jacob sees this person, sees his face clearly, he's going to die, because it says that later, "I have wrestled with God. I've seen God's face and I'm still alive." Jacob recognized this person as somehow identified with God. And for man to see God was for man to die. So the fear of the wrestler is not personal fear, but fear for Jacob's sake. That's all I can make out of this. Now, look what Jacob says to him. "But Jacob said, 'I will not let you go unless you bless me.'" Well, obviously, we've got to have somebody here more than just a man. A man can't bless Jacob. And an angel just can't bless him. Again, God is going to have to deal with Jacob. So it's a personage who represents God. Here is Jacob's test. Jacob has tried to run his own life. He has tried to manipulate people. He has tried to trick people. He has tried to grab the promise. And now God's saying, "You're going to have to trust me." Jacob is saying, "Look, I can't make it on my own. I need a blessing from you. I need some of you. I'm not going to let go of you till you bless me." Now, something of this is caught up in Esau, who's going to meet him tomorrow. Jacob is afraid. He can't handle this problem on his own. But it's important to Jacob that he face his brother in trust in God. Remember in Matthew chapter 5, about verse 23, where it says, "If you bring something to the altar and you have aught against your brother, to leave your sacrifice and go and be right with your brother and then come back and offer your sacrifice." Jacob has got to change. His life has got to change. His attitude has got to change. His modus operandi has got to change. He says, "Bless me or I won't let you go." The tenacity of the man's still there, but he's switching his foundation from his own intellect to trust in God, seemingly. And so the wrestler said to him, that divine personage says, "What is your name?" Now, he knows his name. Why ask him a question like that? He said, "Jacob," because the name Jacob had significance. The names of Hebrew people are extremely significant. By saying Jacob, Jacob reminded that he had always been characterized as a trickster, a manipulator, a usurper. Okay? And the wrestler, this divine personage, says, "Your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with me and have prevailed." Notice the two things. Here's God on one side and me on the other. So this guy who's wrestling with him isn't claiming to be God, though Jacob recognizes him as some kind of emissary or ambassador or representative of God. So there's a distinction made here. Now, here is where the name Israel is defined. Literally, it means... Etymologically, it means, "May El persevere." Now, I don't think it's saying Jacob is so tenacious. I think it's saying God is being tenacious by working with Jacob and his tricks. God's the one who's kept the faith, not Jacob. And Jacob is going to be characterized by God is faithful. Not Jacob is faithful, because he's still called Jacob and Israel, mixed back and forth in the rest of the book. God is faithful. So Israel means God is faithful. God will persevere. Now, notice what it mentions. The word God here is the word Elohim. Some say it means divine person, because the name Elohim can mean angels or can mean God. But the whole context, some say it starts with angels, so it should be angels instead of God through here. But I really think the usage seems to be deity, not angel or angelic beings. Now it says, notice verse 29. Jacob asked him and said, "Tell me your name." But this personage said, "Why is it you ask my name?" And he blessed him there. To know the name was somehow to have insight into a person's character. And Jacob wouldn't know who he was dealing with. But the personage wouldn't tell him who he is. Why? Is that a mystery? Well, there's two views. One says it's just a regular old angel. His name's not important. But maybe it wasn't time for Jacob to know who this was. Maybe it is, in a real sense, the pre-incarnate Christ. Though I think Jesus is a better wrestler than have Jacob tie him. So there's all kinds of loose ends in this account. Now, notice we're in verse 38. So Jacob named the place Peniel, which means the face of God. There's a play on this consonantal form all the way through here, mentioned several times. "I have seen the God face to face, yet my life has been preserved." You might see Judges 13:22. Jacob realized he was wrestling with somebody more than just some man that caught him in the dark and wrestled with him. Jacob thought it was deity. Okay? Now, Now the sun rose upon him just as he crossed over Penuel. That's a place name. It seems to be a play on the words from the place name in verse 31 and the name of the place, Peniel, in verse 30, and the same use of this face. These Hebrew words mean face. It's a play on that noun stem. And he was limping on his thigh. God wanted him to realize it wasn't some dream or it wasn't some mental thing, it wasn't some vision. The dude's limping. Something happened to him. Now, whether he limped for the rest of his life or limped just for a few days is not real sure biblically. It never says he was permanently disabled, but it seems to fit into the new change of his name that he's going to be someone who trusts in God's preserving, not in him preserving himself. Notice it says, therefore this day the sons of Israel do not eat the sinew of the hip. Now, rabbinical sources say this means the vein, the blood vein in the hip. Some say it means that whole area of meat. I'm not sure exactly which it is. I think Hosea 12:3-4 is a real key to interpreting this text. And I think what Jacob understands this wrestling match to be is very important. But here's an example that we can't answer all the questions. We just don't have enough biblical evidence. Let's don't go further than the Bible goes itself. Let's don't get so curious we read too many things in the Bible. Strange account. Let's leave it there. Well, I hope you'll send for the free tape on the spiritual realm called What Battle from Ephesians 6. And I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week.